And we're back. Hustle and Grind Podcast, episode 5. One quarter of the way to 20 episodes. Slowly but surely, we're getting there. Been a little busy. Had this one recorded for like 2 weeks now, but I've been too busy hustling and grinding to get my shit together and get the episode up. But better late than never. We got a doctor in the house today. That's right, Dr. John Bodycomb, psychologist extraordinaire. Excited to hear about his business and his private practice that he has been building up slowly. I have known Dr. John Bodycomb since before he was a doctor, still working on his doctorate, and it's been really cool to see him talk about starting this practice, to doing it full time. So, without further delays from me, here he is. Dr. John Bodycomb in the house. What's up, man?
What's going on, man?
Excited to have you on here.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So you're the first, what I would call either doctor or kind of studio office business, right, okay, that we got on here.
Okay.
So give us a little teaser about what you do before we dive right into it.
Sure. So I'm a pre-licensed clinical psychologist. I am here in Colorado. I have my doctorate in clinical psychology, and I was trained to be a generalist, but I own my own practice, which I provide mainly therapy. I'll do some consultation services, a little bit of assessment, but mostly my focus is a therapy with adult individuals, and I specialize kind of in working with I like to joke that it's like millennial therapy. I work with a lot of people in their 20s and 30s.
Okay.
I have a background in college counseling, and so that really kind of helps me with that population. But, you know, working on relationship issues, identity issues, career issues, stuff like that.
Okay, cool.
And then that stuff usually presents itself like, you know, depression, anxiety, stuff like that.
But right.
Those are the ways.
Gotcha. So I know you've had a little bit of a journey to get to this point. So tell us how you got here. Let's start at undergrad and give us a little bit of background on your journey to licensed psychologist.
Yeah, that's a roundabout journey, man.
Yeah, I know. That's why I brought it up.
Okay. Yeah, no, so I went to undergrad at Ohio State, the Ohio State University.
Nice.
And I graduated 2005. And at the time, I studied theater. I got my Bachelor in Arts in theater. And I picked theater, I mean, because I enjoyed it and I was passionate about it, but also because I was one of those like 18-year-old kids who really didn't have a whole lot of idea of like, what do I want to do for a career? And so I went in during orientation day and I was originally undeclared and I was like, meh. Like, I remember thinking like, oh, I could major in theater, I could major in chemistry, or I could major in aviation. It was like all over the place. But yeah, so I ended up doing that. I graduated 2005.
No interest in psychology at this point.
Well, you know, it's hard to say, honestly. Like, so psychology is something that I've always had a lot of respect for and a lot of interest in. I took a AP Psych class in high school. It's also a little bit tough because a lot of the exposure you get to psychology until, like, my main interest in psychology is about this. It's about providing mental health services. And you don't really get a lot of exposure to that side of psychology until you're pretty far along in your education. And additionally, I didn't like school that much. I never expected myself to go to graduate school. So yeah, that kind of came around a little bit later. It was something I remember thinking like, oh, like all, you know, I really like this field. I'd be interested in it, but I wouldn't want to do it unless I like really went in it and got my doctorate. And I was like, I'm never going to go get my doctorate. So don't really see that happening. And of course, that eventually changed when I was in my late 20s.
Right. So, yeah. So tell us a little bit about what you were doing after undergrad and when you decided to go back to school and why you picked this degree.
Sure, totally. So, so after undergrad, I moved to New York City to pursue a career in acting, which is an adventure for pretty much anybody. I worked in a lot of like new works and did like children's theater and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, theater is a tough business to make a career in. So
yeah,
I always
no
had
doubt.
Second jobs and stuff like that. Worked a lot in restaurants and bars and also did technical work and, you know, just anything to really pay rent. And over the years, it really just got tiring. Mm-hmm. and you know, the work was always very meaningful for me when it was there, but a lot of the time was spent looking for the work, not actually doing the work.
Right.
And so it was actually in my mid 20s. I was having a little bit of a hard time. I was less satisfied with it. I didn't really see what direction my life was going in. And frankly, I was pretty depressed at the time. I kind of, once I made the decision, you know, when you kind of commit to a career in the arts, at least in my experience, it's tough to kind of veer from that because everybody all the way tells you how tough it is. And so you really shouldn't do it unless you're really committed. And so for me, that meant like digging my heels in and saying like, nah, I got this. I'm definitely going to stick it out. And then it got me into a pickle when I was no longer happy with that. So eventually I kind of, you know, through a lot of things, conversations with friends, I entered into my own therapy. I started, just kind of trying to figure out what it is that I really valued in life and like what was important and, you know, that there were different ways for me to be able to meet that. And, you know, working as a bartender also, right? Like, I mean, I would sit and I would have these conversations with people and they would come in and tell me like the heaviest stuff. Like,
yeah.
Wait, am I allowed to swear on this?
Oh, yeah. Oh,
okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. They would tell me like the heaviest shit and I would have like nothing to do other than like to offer them like a beer and say like, oh, I'm sorry. But I think it's also been like a big part of my personality to kind of connect people on that way in deep ways. And so there was a part of me that was always drawn to this and there's lots of psychological reasons for that, but that's a bigger story than.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Well, that's cool. It's good to hear about how you came here, and I knew a little bit of that story beforehand, so that's why I wanted to go into it.
Yeah.
So you went to school. I know that it was a very long process, and we don't need to dive through the whole thing.
Sure.
But give us a sense of how long it took, and what went into becoming a licensed psychologist.
Well, you know, from the point where I decided that this was an avenue that I wanted to pursue to where I'm at now, I mean, that was 7 or 8 years, which, you know, thinking back on is pretty fucking daunting.
Yeah, it's a long, big journey.
But, you know, I mean, I think I just kind of put my one foot ahead of the other. Like, I started out volunteering in different, like, I volunteered on a suicide hotline. I started volunteering on a research project. I, you know, started taking night and weekend classes because I hadn't taken any psych classes and I had to make all the prereqs. So that was like a 1 to 2 year process. I applied, I applied right out of the gate, just to see what kind of responses I got. And I got a couple of interviews, but I didn't get into anywhere that first year.
Mm-hmm.
So I spent the next year kind of continuing to build stuff up and then applied again and got in that second year. And that's when I came out here to Denver. And then since then, I mean, once you get into a doctoral program, and there's two different kinds of doctoral programs. There's PsyDs and there's PhDs, at least within psychology.
Right.
And those vary a little bit. You know, traditionally, like the PsyD model came out in the 70s, and it's traditionally focused a little bit more on practitioners rather than researchers. And there's different models within those things. But anyways, so I chose a PsyD because I knew, again, like what I wanted out of this field was to work with people and to be able to, like, be a therapist and do all that stuff. So.
And when you're mentioning the difference between PsyD and PhD,
mm-hmm.
There's also master's levels and below clinicians, right? So could you explain a little bit of the difference between the levels of clinician and kind of how you're different from a social worker or, you know, I don't even know the names of the other levels.
No,
but
no,
you know what
I mean,
I'm talking about.
Yeah,
there's a lot
of
types of therapists
out
there.
Exactly. Yeah. And a lot of that varies, I mean, both on the amount of training that you get, but also the model through which you get trained, right? So as a master's level clinician, you could be coming from social work. You could be an MFT, marriage and family therapist. There's LPCs. And, you know, so where you get licensed is it kind of varies a little bit. I mean, what traditionally sets psychologists apart from that is one, the amount of training, the number of years that you have to put in to do so.
Right.
Two, assessment is something that's primarily our domain.
Mm-hmm.
Doing psychological assessment, identifying, disabilities or personality stuff, right? The stuff like that. But as time has gone on, honestly, that's something that mental health is really still trying to shake out because there's so many different kinds of mental health practitioners that different people get pigeonholed into different roles. And there's like a lot of the research bears out that, you know, what degree you have doesn't necessarily have any correlation with like the quality of care that you're providing. And so there's a lot of other factors that go in. Instead, you know, people like psychologists often nowadays are kind of getting funneled into more administrative roles, more supervision, stuff like that. So it's kind of all over the place, which is, you know, that's kind of the other thing, right? Like, I wanted to get my doctorate and I wanted to provide therapy. And if I wanted to just provide therapy, it would have been a much shorter path to go and get a master's degree and start working straight out the field. And for me, I think, one, I wanted the extra training. I just wanted to be really good at what I do. And B, I'm blanking on what I was just going to say.
Happens to me all the time.
My God.
Well, we'll keep rolling. Don't you worry. I got plenty of questions.
Oh, no, actually, no. So two was from actually a little bit more of a business perspective. I always kind of knew that I wanted to have my own practice.
Yeah.
You know, growing up, my parents were both lawyers and they both like were independent practice lawyers. And so I saw both the stresses that came along with it, but also the benefits of being your own boss and the flexibility that was offered there. And so I wanted to, when I entered into this field, I wanted to be kind of in a smaller pool of competition when I got there.
Right. Well, that's a perfect segue because the next section I'm ready to dive into the business being a small private practitioner.
Now, you know, I'm still figuring this all out.
I know,
right?
But that's the point of the show, man. We haven't made it yet. We're all figuring it out together.
Yeah.
Once you have your degree, and not just your degree, because I know there's more than that, your license, you've passed everything, you're ready to go. Dr. Bodycomb, what do you need to open a private practice? What are the initial costs to get started before you even see your first patient?
That's a good question, a big one. Are you talking for more of a, like a monetary number, or are you talking about?
I'm not saying like what, not necessarily what the number is, but what are the costs? Like rent is obviously one, but I'm sure there's other things you needed in order to start seeing patients. I'm just trying to get a sense for what those are.
No, absolutely. I mean, yeah, so fortunately, my business is a very low overhead business, and that's one of the best things that you can do about it, right? Like, I don't hire anybody to do, like, I do all my own scheduling, I do all my own billing, at least the way that I run it right now.
Right.
That may change in the future, but right now, it's easy enough for me to handle that. So really, I mean, it was about getting a space, it was about furnishing that space, it was about, you know, the business aspects of it, right? Like, you know, incorporating, getting business insurance, having liability insurance. As a healthcare provider, we have to have liability insurance, like medical doctors,
right?
A lot more affordable than medical doctors, but
right?
Yeah, so there's those aspects. There's then, of course, you know, marketing and stuff like that. You know, again, a lot of this is a little more gray as far as like where you want to put that money, but you do need to start getting referrals from somewhere,
right?
And so, you know, there's some very basic listings that in my field you really need to be on. Psychology Today, Good Therapy is a good one. There's just a bunch of stuff like that, and those things usually come with a subscription service that you kind of go along with.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, there's a number of subscription services I'm a part of. And then there's some professional dues. I joined the Colorado Psychological Association, American Psychological Association, stuff like that. I mean, you know, where all those things bear out and whether they're necessary at the beginning is maybe a bigger question. But, you know, one of the biggest things, especially in my line of work, right, referrals are mainly driven by word of mouth or from other practitioners. And so in order to do that, you need to kind of be having your name out there and like what you do out there, you know, in the right places. So if you think about like, if you have a friend who's going through something who might benefit from therapy, like where are they going to go to try to find somebody who's going to be a good fit, right? And a lot of this comes down to like, you know, oh, I have this friend that like got really helped by this guy, or you call a clinician that like maybe you have a previous relationship with, or maybe your partner's seeing, and they're going to refer you to somebody that they know and they trust. And, you know, I think there's just a lot of word of mouth and a lot of networking that's involved in this kind of business. I got a little off tangent from your startup cost question.
No worries, because that's all part of it. So it sounds to me that the biggest expense to get started is an office and space, right?
Yeah, that's the biggest. And honestly, like, you know, fortunately, you don't have to necessarily start out like getting your own place and like signing a lease and all that stuff. There's a lot of subletting that happens in our business. So there's kind of two ways that people go in starting a private practice. They either do what I did, which is like kind of jump full feet in and be like, I don't know how I'm going to pay rent, but I'm going to start, you know, just doing my practice full time.
Right.
Or, you know, you get either a full-time or a part-time job, and then you build up a practice on the side and then eventually plan for the transition over to that.
Okay.
And, you know, where you are, how you decide to do that kind of impacts some of that. Because, right, if you're only doing a two-day-a-week practice, it may not make sense for you to sign a lease on a place, whereas subletting might be a much better idea for you. There are buildings and organizations around here that you, like, pay a membership fee for, and then you can basically rent by the hour kind of thing.
Right.
That are specialized towards, like, healthcare and mental health and stuff like that.
Oh, so interesting. You know, that's a whole other business model.
Yeah, Sondermind is one of the organizations around here. Cool. And stuff. And I think they come with their own caveats and things, but that's definitely a road that some people go down.
Right. Now, you mentioned that you decided to jump right in and start your own private practice, but we're sitting in a very nice office, but it's also not a luxurious, 10-room office, and You just tell us a little bit about this space here that we're in and how you kind of keep the cost down here.
Sure thing, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's different things that I weighed in mind when I was trying to pick out an office. Originally I started out by subletting from a friend of mine. If I'm honest, I'm more borrowed his office for a while. And so that really kind of allowed me to help build up a little bit of a clientele while I still had very little overhead. And then it was in the last month or so that, you know, my practice was growing enough and other people's that I have other colleagues that I'm currently sharing this space with, that they were kind of in the same position. And so we decided to look for a place. And, you know, there are different considerations there. Again, our needs are very low as therapists. Literally, I need an office that's enough to fit however many clients that I have. I need a small waiting room, ideally, even though you can probably get away without having a waiting room.
Right.
And then you need to make sure that things like privacy are important and respected and stuff like that. And then I want to be in a good location. Like, people are coming to see me on a regular basis, and oftentimes it's like when they can sneak out in between work or something like that. And so convenience is really important to me. I'm also providing a professional service, and I'm charging a reasonable rate for it. And so I want this to be a professional looking building. I don't want somebody to run up and, you know, I remember I was talking to my dad about this. You walk the line, right? Like, you don't want to find a place that's so cheap and janky that people are like, what kind of services am I getting here?
Right.
But you also don't want somebody to step into a lobby and then be overwhelmed by how fancy it is and clutching their wallet and being like, what did I just get myself into?
Right.
And so this place really worked out well for me. I mean, you know, no landlord relationship is perfect, but at the same point in time, it's really worked out nicely. And, fortunately, commercial, office space is pretty affordable, I've found around here, especially. And that's part of the other reason. So there's actually three businesses in this office, and we're all independent businesses, but we have gone on the lease together. And we have a 3-year kind of plan right now.
Yeah.
We expect that in the next 2 to 5 years, right? Like, we're all going to have to start making decisions about where we're taking our businesses, because that's when our caseloads are going to start to get full. And, you know, as a therapist, there's only so many hours in the day, only so many hours I can spend doing this work. And so you have to kind of decide where you're taking your business there. You know, sometimes that involves bringing on other clinicians, getting more supervisory, doing all that kind of stuff.
Right.
Also, you know, you can branch out into other ways that, like, psychology isn't necessarily thought of as traditionally, right? And that can be anything from, like, consultation. Like, there was a professor at my school that would come in. They did, he worked for a big consultation firm, and they did evaluation for goodness of fit for CE-level executives or C-level executives. And so there's lots of different ways that you can kind of use the education that you have that is something that not a lot of other people have to try to, you know, come up with new business ideas and stuff like that.
When you say you share this office, because I walked into a waiting room and then there was multiple rooms. So is it only you in this office?
Correct.
Or you share the suite?
Yeah. So we share the suite.
And you share the waiting room.
And we share the waiting room. This office is mine and mine alone.
Got it.
The office next door is shared by a husband and wife combo that are in practice together.
Right.
And then across the way is a guy who's got a part-time practice, and he also sublets to another clinician.
Oh, okay. So you got
hours.
The whole thing going on here.
Yeah, we got pretty much the whole
no
thing.
No receptionist or anything, right? Just a waiting room.
Exactly.
Got it.
I mean, because again, we could have a receptionist, but that's a big overhead piece that is just not that necessary these days. Like, it's so easy to communicate and schedule and
Right. So let's get into, it's not the most important thing when you're dealing with people's health, but when you're running a business, the most important thing is money, of course.
Of course.
We all got to make money. So
and we got to survive all the way.
We got to survive all the way, man. On the journey. From what I know, these types of practices are either insurance-driven or private pay.
Right.
So talk about the breakdown, your mix of patients. Are you mostly insurance? Are you mostly private pay?
Yeah.
And, you know, how did you decide what to do with that?
Sure, totally. So my practice is all private pay.
All private pay.
So I can provide clients with what's called a super bill, and they can submit for out-of-network reimbursement to your insurance to their insurance companies, but I am not contracted with any insurance companies. And the reason for that starting out, honestly, is very pragmatic in the sense that at the beginning I said I'm a pre-licensed psychologist, mm-hmm. and that's because I am still working on licensure here in Colorado, and so I have a supervisor who I... So these laws and rules vary state by state, but here in Colorado, you can have an outside supervisor. So I have a supervisor that I pay who supervises my caseload and kind of keeps an eye on all that stuff. But before I'm licensed, I can't be contracted with an insurance company.
Okay.
And so that was never really an option for me. Now, to be honest, I wasn't necessarily looking at doing that anyways. So it's tough. My business... You're talking about a couple of questions when you talk about insurance, right? You're talking about things like reimbursement rate. You're talking about things like access to care,
right?
Like there's a lot of big questions that kind of come up about that. But there are significant challenges here. So I don't know a whole lot about how they set their reimbursement rates, but I do know that they vary wildly based on where you're at, right? So, you know, private insurance companies' reimbursement rates here in Colorado, and a lot of this that I'm about to start saying is a lot of hearsay because you hear it from other clinicians and stuff like that. But this is my best information. You know, in Colorado, reimbursement rates vary based on private insurance companies. They're like, let's say on the low end, let's say $60 a session, and on the high end, maybe $90 a session. If you get up to $100 a session, then you're getting great reimbursement.
Okay.
And actually, Medicaid reimburses really well here in Colorado. Again, all hearsay, but they're supposed to be somewhere in the 90s. Medicaid, if I said Medicare.
No, Medicaid, yeah.
Okay. But if you look at other places, right, like I have a friend who's another psychologist here, and she moved up here from Dallas, and her colleagues that are down there working, right, their reimbursement rates are set near to like 110, 120, stuff like that. Same thing in Chicago. I did my capstone internship for my program in Chicago, and reimbursement rates for different companies, you know, I've heard go up towards like 150.
Wow.
Now, if you look at like cost of living between Denver and Chicago, it's really not that different. So, I mean, I've hypothesized that maybe they set a lot of this regionally and we're a very anomalous place regionally. But because of that, it's very tough to like want to build a business based on insurance. The one thing that you really do get out of that is your marketing is basically taken care of. There are so many people out there that want to use their insurance to pay for their therapy. And why wouldn't they, right? They have mental health benefits. It makes sense why they would want to. But again, like they only contract with a certain number of practitioners in an area. Right now, it's pretty tough to get contracted with a lot of the different insurance companies around here. But so if you do take insurance, right, like you're pretty much full.
Mm-hmm.
And you're pretty much full like all the way.
Wow.
Which is, you know, a huge benefit, right? Like that's a lot of time you're saving on marketing, on, you know, there's a lot less big question marks. I'd say you're saving time on billing, but honestly, dealing with billing insurance companies
is a nightmare.
You, probably
I could imagine.
Not.
Yeah.
I've got limited experience in it from a physical therapy practice I used to work in New York City, but they, it's a beast.
Question on insurance. Can you develop long-term relationships with clients when they're paying through insurance, or does insurance only cover a certain number of visits?
So again, I'm not the best person for you to ask for that because I haven't gone through it personally. One of my concerns was about to be because I do a lot of long-term kind of depth-based work.
Right.
And so that was one of my concerns when I was thinking about my practice. On the other hand, I've talked to a lot of colleagues who take insurance and it seems like it's maybe less of a barrier than it seems than I was nervous it was going to be. That yes, right? Like managed care, the purpose of managed care is that they'll sit there and they'll say, okay, where are the clients where's progress coming from? And like, you know, there'll be things where, you know, if it, you want to show that there's enough progress that it justifies keep paying for it, but you don't want to show so much progress that this person like, oh, doesn't need therapy. Because again, measuring progress within something like therapy is a very tricky thing, right? Like,
right.
We'll look at symptom reduction. We'll look at like ADLs if you're talking about, that's activities of daily living. Like if you're talking about somebody that's lower functioning, but honestly, like, you know, the type of work that I do, it, you know, like I said at the beginning, right, I help people with like, I kind of specialize in like relationship issues, identity use, career issues. I also do a fair amount of trauma work with stuff like that. Like, you know, if somebody's coming in because they just lost their job or they're having a career crisis or they're going through a divorce or right. Like the path that that looks like for everybody is very, very different. And so, you know, it's tough to kind of translate that between a managed care. Honestly, I think a lot of it boils down to the fact that health insurance and managed care is been developed based on a medical model. And in my view, psychological conditions are not excellently. There's some overlap definitely with medical model, but I think that it's poorly overly applied.
You can't standardize it when someone's feeling better.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Exactly.
It's probably up to a little bit of the patient too, I would imagine. Yeah,
so much of the work that I do is subjective, and that's frustrating for a lot of people, right? But at the same point in time, like your reality and you feeling better, like how you feel kind of defines your reality, and you telling me how you feel is kind of a big part of like our work together, right?
Right.
So yeah, it's tricky.
You mentioned earlier a lot of the different ways that you can market yourself to get new patients, but what did you do specifically? So you decided to, you know, jump in with 2 feet, open your own practice. How did you get your first patient and how did you build up your caseload to the point where you're doing this near full time now?
Yeah. So, you know, I think I talked to a lot of practitioners and I talked to a lot of people about like, oh, what are ways? And I did a lot of brainstorming about like, oh, what are different ways I could go to try to build my business? And honestly, I think what ended up, I think there's a couple of things to it, honestly. One, I kind of gravitated towards the things that felt like they fit well with me, like that fit my personality and my comfort level. And so for me, I'm a very extroverted. I'm a very like social kind of person. And so I got very involved with a lot of like professional organizations. I started going to, you know, networking events. I got organized with a local organization of psychologists and started hosting a networking event.
Oh, wow.
Like, yeah, I just kind of jumped in on that social aspect because that's one of my big strengths. And so I tried to go with that. You know, I think that there were a lot of plans. I still have a lot of, like, I've got a big list of like different like marketing ideas that like I plan to get to, but haven't gotten to yet. But those have been the things that are big for me. But all that being said, to be honest, it's, you know, so my business is a little bit different than if you're kind of starting a business out of the blue. You know, remember earlier I said that I kind of got a doctorate because I wanted to have a narrow competition pool and kind of, you know, be able to do that. Because of that, I think that because of the type of service that I provide and the type of business that I have, it's a little bit more predictable, it sounds like as far as like business growing. Not to say that every practice works out or follows the same path, and I've certainly heard a lot of variation, but a lot of the numbers that I heard from people were like, yo, okay, so if you have an awesome niche and there's going to be a ton of referrals coming your way, you could be full in like 6 months. Most people, about 2 years to having a full practice. And I, so far that seems to be bearing out pretty true. I've been open in business for almost a year exactly. And I'd say I'm a little more than half full. I'm probably about 60-70% full, right now. So yeah. So really for me, it was about, you know, doing make sure your base is covered as far as like what, you know, having a website, like having all that kind of stuff out there so that when people like see you, they see that you're a legitimate business. And then leveraging my strengths, which is going out there and getting my name out there. And then over time, right, doing good work with people and letting that word spread. I think that's the other thing, right? Like making sure that the work and the service that you're providing is good. There's always room for people that are good at what they do. And so do that good work and let that spread. But that's more of a slower kind of osmosis. So
would you say it's the people that you met at the networking events who came to see you, or did they provide a referral for
you?
No,
yeah, mostly it's been providing a referral.
They provide
honestly,
referrals,
and
wow.
I networked at most, I did some networking in different kind of arenas. A lot of it has been around like more like healthcare professionals and stuff like that, because again, that's where people are going to be going to get referrals for therapy. But, you know, I did do a couple of more like kind of wide open networking events with all sorts of different people. And those never really panned out that well for me. I almost got a couple of like direct referrals where you meet somebody who's like, I need therapy. But for the most part, when I'm getting the word out, it's about getting it to other professionals and other kind of secure sources. You know, I also got on like on, you know, the universities around here, they all have referral lists and stuff like that. And so, you know, there's just a lot of ways that I tried to get my name and my reputation out. And then people, you know, if it's another therapist who's got a practice that's full and they're looking for a referral,
interesting.
If it's a doctor who's looking to help somebody out with an issue that, you know, is a little outside their specialty, but you know, I think it's that kind of stuff.
You're hustling, man, the hustle and the grind. I love
it.
Get
so
your name
hard.
Out there. That's how it's done.
Dude, I just got back from a vacation, and I like you get so caught up in the rat race and stuff that, like, you know, I'm always get caught in this mindset of like, oh, I got to do more. I got to keep hustling. I got to keep going. And I got back from vacation, and you always, you know, I always feel like I could be doing more. But then I got back from vacation, and I like jumped right back into like, you know, working, and I was like, holy shit. I work really fucking hard.
Yeah,
like,
man.
All of a sudden, I'm submitted back into it, and I'm like, oh, this is like nonstop, isn't it? Okay, cool.
It's tough, man. It's not easy street.
No.
One last question on marketing.
Sure.
Do you find as a marketing strategy to differentiate yourself as a doctorate versus a master's level clinician? And does that play into it at all?
Yeah, no.
Do you find people are seeking that or no?
I find that there's I don't ask all my patients why they chose me. I probably should, actually. That's a good idea. The answer to most of that is honestly because they got my name from somebody else. You know, I think that for a segment of my caseload, that is a big deal. That they want somebody who has a doctorate that they feel like, you know, again, they're usually not in a good place if they're coming to see me. And so they want to make sure that where they're going and where they're putting their resources into getting help is going to be something that's going to pay off. Again, that's not always necessarily a deciding factor, but I think for some people it is important. And as far as like how well do I market it? I mean, so when I market that stuff, I certainly do market, you know, I always have my title with my name. I don't go by Dr. Bodycomb in general, like with my clients. Like it's weird. With maybe more of a business kind of setting or an assessment kind of setting, I wear that title. And I think that that's something that helps to differentiate me. But I don't love, you know, again, my work is more based on working collaboratively with somebody. And so something that sets us apart like that can sometimes work against you. How much has it panned out? It's really tough to tell, honestly.
Right.
But I, you know, I'm glad that it's there, and it certainly helped me to connect with other clinicians that are of my level. Of my level of training. I do think that, you know, when it comes to other professionals making the referral, again, I think that that does end up bearing out to them in some ways because. You know, there's just a bigger pool of master's clinicians. They can be awesome. They can blow me out of the water. Like I'm sure some of them, but like at the same point in time, like there's a smaller pool of people that have a doctorate. And so for some people, that's a more comfortable thing for them.
Right. Long-term vision. Where do you see this going? How do you plan to scale it up to support you and a family down the road and set yourself up, for, you know, for your successful life and how, when you envision
figure it out every goddamn day,
you know, man, like what are you thinking about? What do you see when you look into the future?
Yeah, man. I mean, like I said, I'm not 100% sure. Like when I kind of took off, like I've got like loose plans and general ideas and then see where it goes. My goals for right now, I've been kind of making those steps towards, right? Like get my own office, you know, get myself established in the community. So I'm getting good referrals, work on getting a full caseload. That's where I'm at. Once I get to that point, I have to kind of make a decision as far as what I want to do, or once I, you know, start to get closer to that. And I anticipate that again being in the next 2 years-ish, mm-hmm. I'm guessing. I'm not sure, right? There's a part of me that wants to try to grow into a bigger clinic. And I tried to structure my business like, you know, I did an LLC. I've kind of separated my name from my business name, and my marketing materials focuses on my business name so that if I do want to transition into bringing other clinicians on here, it's going to be easier to maintain those kind of that same reputation and then get them connected to people who are working for me.
Right.
Right. And there's a lot of, so that's what's called a group practice. And a group practice, they can be structured differently, but often within my field, you know, they'll operate on kind of like a contract basis, and they'll do like a split on the fees. The idea being that like the person who owns the practice handles like things like rent and things like marketing and all stuff like that. We'll send referrals that way. And, you know, as a recompense for that, they'll take a percentage of the fees from your client sessions. And those can vary wildly from like 50-50 to 60-40 to 70-30. Like, they're kind of all over the map.
Yeah.
So that's one thing I could do. I also have so I wrote my doctoral paper, which is in our program, like, it's kind of equivalent to a dissertation, though not quite as tough. Which
okay.
Was really appreciated. So I wrote that on developing actually video games to be used as intervention strategies in young adults. And so, you know, I think that there's, there's a part of me that wants to branch out a little bit more and to try to integrate, you know, mental health care, my experience, my knowledge into other types of businesses that are trying to help people. I mean, you know, you see those apps out, like, you know, trying to, what's the big one that right now, that meditation and all.
Oh,
that?
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't remember right now.
I thought you meant the texting therapy. I see that one.
They
too.
Do have those. Yeah. Talkspace and a couple of other ones.
Right.
Those are all pretty big. You know, obviously you need to do something that fits well for you and is, both like professionally and ethically. But for me, I would like to try to find some other ways to branch out in doing that.
Yeah.
I don't know exactly what that looks like. And I'm kind of, you know, looking at the research of what's coming out and also just kind of running through my brain of like, what would I like to do?
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Well, that's just interesting. Someone I think about, like, cause once you have a full caseload, it's like, now you got to think about how can I generate more income on top of that? But mm-hmm. You can only see more patients, you
exactly.
know?
Exactly.
So,
well, and I operate on a sliding scale. So, again, I'm all private pay, but I negotiate and I have a standard fee, but, you know, based on, you know, people who have needs but don't have the financial means to be able to seek services. Because again, when I went back to the insurance question, right, there's like the reimbursement, but there's also the access to care question. And being a provider, right, like I want to be able to provide care to people who can't afford, like I don't only want to be able to provide therapy to the super rich.
Right.
But, you know, I also a hefty amount of student loan debt that I have to figure out how
right.
to deal with. And so
right.
there's a balance in all of that. But you know, as time goes on, right, like this is kind of where I'm at with my business right now. I need to reevaluate my sliding scale policy as far as how much of my caseload I reserve for it and what the parameters are on that. But you're right. Like there's kind of a cap once you hit a certain, and it's not like you can even look, if you're a therapist and you can do 40 client hours a week, then more power to you. But the vast majority of us cut it off around 25
yeah,
or 30.
Yeah, it's a lot, yeah.
Because again, every hour that I do that is some hour that I'm sitting here and staring someone in the face and listening as intently as I can to what they're saying and being emotionally connected, right? Like, it's not like where I can sip a coffee and like, you know, work on a spreadsheet or something, which I've done before, and that's hard work. I'm not trying to make that sound bad.
Yeah.
But it takes a different level of attention.
Right. Last question.
Yeah.
What I'd like to call pain points in your business. Mm-hmm. What are your pain points in your business right now? What's holding you back from growing at this moment? Or, you know, what's causing you the most trouble?
That's a good question. Yeah, man.
Maybe it's just new patients, you know, maybe you just got to fill up that book, you know?
I mean, that's definitely a piece of it, but those are slowly rolling in.
Honestly,
I think, honestly, what I'd like to do next is kind of continue to narrow my focus a little bit, right? Like I'm going to have professional development as a clinician alongside business development as a business owner. And so I think I'd like to continue to develop like more refined ideas of like, what it is that I'm really good at and who it is I'm really good at helping. When it comes to like, what's the pain point? What's the next step? Like, how do I do that? So there's two things that are kind of coming to mind, right? One being, you know, kind of what I brought up earlier of just handling the financial aspect of this business and like, you know, my policies regarding sliding scale, my policies regarding payment, like all those kind of things. Because there's a couple of things around there that could really be tightened up and better defined, I think. And we get like no training in how to run a business through my you know, schooling, which, you know, they should probably address, but, you know, whatever, that's their problem. And then the other thing that I'm thinking of, honestly, of another pressure point is, you know, if I decide to take this next step of like expanding my practice, right? If I decide to bring on another clinician, then I have to like walk this line as, you know, you bring someone in, but, you know, referrals are kind of a slow roll kind of thing. And it's something that like, it's not like I can bring someone in and then have them have a full like caseload right away. So what does that mean, right? Does, if I'm doing that on a contract basis, how do I attract somebody who's quality and who's willing to do that work when I can't promise how much they're going to be making off the get-go or how long it's going to take to fill like that? If I hire somebody and I'm paying that, right, like how am I going to cover that gap between when I have them earning me the maximum that I can and the cost of like paying somebody's salary?
Yeah.
And so I think those are the big things. And then just like the other, you know, being a small business owner, you know, right, the other considerations, things like health insurance, like save, like all those things that you now have to take care of on your own. Those are the other big things that are just, I mean, those are going to be an ongoing part of this business.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Well, I feel your pain, man. It's always hard to figure out how you're going to pay for the next big step. And that's probably the biggest thing that holds most of us back.
Yeah.
But, this has been really interesting and learning about the intersection between healthcare and business.
Yeah, totally.
It's awesome to see you. It has been interesting, and it's cool to see you making it happen. You know?
Yeah, thanks, man. I really appreciate it. You know, this. Obviously, the story that you're getting from me is my story and my story alone. But, you know, I think that you know, I have a lot of colleagues that have been doing the same thing, and it's a heck of a thing.
No, it's inspiring, and you guys got a really really good looking office space, and
it feels
very professional. So, congratulations on getting here.
We try to inspire the best.
Yeah, man, and I know you guys are going to. Well, I don't know if you're going to be with them long term, but I know that you're going to be making it big time down the road.
Tearing it up. Denver Psychology and Wellness, yo.
Oh, there we go. There Denver Psych and Wellness. Yep, I love it. Give it a plug. Yeah. Well, thanks for doing this and
laying
down
having
some
me.
Wisdom.
And I love the podcast, man. It's great. You've done some awesome work here already, and I think it's great to have people to be able to connect to, like, you know, what it's like to be through like the tough phases of starting a business. And I think that's the other thing, right? Like connecting with other people that like do this, and also connecting to people that have been there before, because people are out there that know what it's like and they want to help. And
yeah. So it's
not to go on another tangent.
No, for sure. I feel you. It's hard. People don't always realize, you know, most of the podcasts out there are about the people who've hit it big.
Yeah.
You know, the mega psychologists of the world.
Yeah. There we go.
But anyway, it's been a lot of fun. So thanks for doing this. Appreciate
thanks for
it,
having
man.
Me. All right.
So there you have it. Little window into the world of starting your own psychology practice. Pretty interesting. I kind of liked the low startup costs of the psychology practice. You know, you just need an office and a desk and a chair. But I forgot about the most important part, the freaking degree. God knows how much that cost. So, you know, at least thankfully after you spend all that time and all that money and all that effort getting that degree, that education, at least the barriers to entry are kind of low to get started. So, you know, I guess a nice little light at the end of the tunnel for that long road if you're thinking about going into your own private practice. Hope you enjoyed the episode. We got more coming up. Now it's time for our newest segment, hashtag sponsored, not sponsored, where we're giving shout outs to people who help me with my business or things that I find helpful. And this week, we're doing a little unsponsored thank you for all the Breakfast Miracle believers out there and preachers. These are people on Instagram who have been spreading the word of the Breakfast Miracle, telling all their friends and their followers about Rooster and Lark. And there's so many, I can't even name them all at this point. I'm losing count. But let's see. We got Meredith, Abundant Wellness Nutrition. We have, Haley, our RDR ex-nutrition, of course, Brooke Zeigler, she's like the number one fan. We have Alex. There's all these people out there just giving a lot of love. Oh, Elizabeth, another Sunny Day blog, of course.
Lauren, Nutrition Now Counseling. I mean, the list goes on and on. All these people are preaching to the world about the Breakfast Miracle. So they did not pay for this sponsor. I don't pay them for their sponsorships. We're just trying to help each other out. And more importantly, they are really getting behind this crazy new veggie mix out there, taking the world by storm, which leads me to our platinum sponsor. You know what I'm talking about, Rooster and Lark. Now, this week with Rooster and Lark, I want to talk about the holidays. We're getting geared up for probably some of the busiest months of the year, October, November, December. Everyone's in the grocery store shopping for their families and Christmas and Hanukkah and Thanksgiving and all that. But with all that family in town, you can't be cooking every meal every day for 12, 15 people. No way. You're going to burn out real fast. You got to head to the store. You got to pick up some Rooster and Lark. Save yourself some time with breakfast. You get 12 eggs. You get a bag of Rooster and Lark. Scramble them up. Boom. Your family's fed. Also, head to the website, roosterandlark.com. You can print off a $1 off coupon and then go to the store locator and drive to the nearest store and pick it up. It's going to be on sale basically all the time throughout the holidays. So become a believer. Spread the Breakfast Miracle. Go buy the Breakfast Miracle. Thanks for listening. We got more episodes coming up. I'm not sure who is available next for recording, but a lot of people in the pipeline, so it's going to be fun. All right. Peace.